All right. Well, the German Revolution. It saw millions of workers in one of the world's most powerful states violently overthrow a rotten and corrupt monarchy and attempt to build a workers' republic. The revolution not only proved that socialism was on the world historic agenda, but it also ended the bloody slaughter of the First World War. And yes, and I was just having another conversation about this literally before this meeting started, this monumental event has been scandalously erased from history. Because the revolution did not win, bourgeois historians have cast the revolution into that historical limbo that all defeated revolts of the working class movement are consigned. Understanding the German Revolution is important for socialists, not just because of the importance of the revolution itself, but because its defeat was a turning point for the defeat of the entire revolutionary period that emerged after the First World War and the subsequent rise of fascism and the Second World War. I'm going to click this thing. Thanks. So the beginning of the German Revolution does not start in Germany itself, but in the first of the warring states during the First World War to undergo a workers' revolution, the Russian Empire. So today, the Russian Revolution is probably connected to the horrors of Stalinism, but in 1918, during the peak of the war, Russia was a beacon of hope for peace. The working class of Russia, led by the Bolsheviks, had established a new social order with workers and peasants in the saddle, whose first priority was ending the World War. They appealed not to the world's rulers, but to the world's workers to overthrow their masters and to end the war. The Bolsheviks themselves took power on the understanding that their revolution would be the first outpost of a world revolution that would sweep away the organized butchery of capitalism. So that's a good quote from Lenin there. I'm going to try and introduce myself anyway. I don't know if I can. But it's a fantastic quote, which is when he was welcoming the just speaking to the Soviet of Petrograd just after they'd overthrown the provisional government. So Germany was the linchpin of the world's working class movement at this time. Goodness, this is annoying. Prior to the war, German social democracy had been the largest socialist party in the world with over 1 million members. It was also the largest party in the German parliament, having received 35% of the vote in 1912. The Social Democratic Party, or SPD by its German acronym, was committed to socialist revolution and opposition to war on paper, but in practice, the SPD had long pursued a reformist and not revolutionary activity. It worked within the existing system rather than struggling against it. And the SPD decisively turned its back on its internationalist and socialist principles in August 1914 when it voted to condone, well, not just condone, but actually actively support the war effort of its own ruling class. So I've got some quotes up there from an SPD newspaper and then the SPD parliamentary caucus days apart, which reflect that change. And in doing so, the SPD was forced not only to basically go along with this conflict, the bloodiest conflict in world's history up to that time, but also to embrace class collaboration and what they called social peace or Burgenfried with the bosses in the state to pursue the objective of winning the war. And 2 million German men died in the conflict, along with massive suppression of wages, conditions, and even starvation in the world's second wealthiest state. So 500,000 people died of starvation in Germany at this time. The betrayal of the SPD was a crisis for the international left, and it prompted opposition within Germany. Karl Liebknecht, pictured there, became the international face of anti-war opposition and the genuine revolutionary tradition when, as an SPD parliamentarian, he alone refused to vote for war funding a few months into the war. Literally, he basically, they wouldn't let him speak, so he just sat there silently, but by not standing up to vote for the war credits, it was a remarkable moment. This opposition slowly cohered into the tendency known as the Spartacus League from January 1916. It was led by revolutionary socialists Rosa Luxemburg, Clara Zetkin, who was the founder of International Working Women's Day, and Franz Mehring, as well as Liebknecht. The Spartacist League denounced the war as a true face of capitalism. So to quote Luxemburg, she said, "This shows that capitalism is not all spick and span and moral pretense to culture, philosophy, ethics, order, peace, and the rule of law, but the ravening beast, the witch's Sabbath of anarchy, a plague to culture and humanity." This group, the Spartacists, was still a faction of the SPD, but they led the first anti-war demonstration in Germany on May Day of 1916, during which Liebknecht publicly denounced the war and was arrested for treason, conscripted and sent to the front. Around the same time, Luxembourg outlined in her pamphlets, the Junius pamphlets, her analysis of the war, arguing that workers had no stake in the victory of either side, but instead should fight to end the war through workers' revolution. So the political activism of the Spartacists took place in a climate of growing working class opposition to the war and increasing numbers of parliamentarians in the Socialist Party refusing to vote for it. But the Spartacists did not form their own separate party. They were afraid of a decisive break with the SPD. They feared isolation from the workers' movement. But some kind of split or rupture within the SPD was actually proving inevitable. The Spartacists, by failing to fight for a clear revolutionary perspective in opposition to the different reformist currents within the SPD, meant that the reformists took the initiative. So there was a mass expulsion of anti-war parliamentarians from the Socialist Party caucus in April of 1917, which led to the formation of an opposition Socialist Party, the Independent Social Democratic Party. I don't know why this is difficult. The USPD by its acronym. Thank you. The USPD was not a clearly revolutionary party. It combined open reformists like Edward Bernstein, who wrote a book called Evolutionary Socialism, and also Karl Kautsky, he's probably the most famous reformist in history, with the avowedly revolutionary Spartacists. And possibly even more significant, the rank and file metal workers network in Berlin, the Revolutionary Shop Stewards, which was led by that fellow up there, Richard Müller. But the reformists were the ones who ran the party. The USPD adopted the old program of the SPD. Basically, they saw that the wartime betrayal was just some aberration from an otherwise good history. The members of the party were not even clearly united around their opposition to the war, whereas the Spartacists wanted to have general strikes, they wanted to actively oppose the war, the reformists just wanted to passively call for peace. So despite this instability, the USPD swiftly emerged as a mass party, really reflecting the sense of rejection of the war and the sacrifices of the war amongst workers, rising to 120,000 members with control over dozens of newspapers, as well as a substantial number of parliamentarians. And during the course of the war and through the betrayals of the party, the official SPD shrunk over the course of the war to just 300,000 members. So on the eve of the German Revolution, in the face of a rising workers' movement, the political organizations of the left were divided between an increasingly right-wing but still popular SPD, a growing but unstable USPD, and within the USPD, a tiny revolutionary current. So this was starting to build up by November of 1918, with an all-pervading sense that the war was doomed to fail in Germany, and sailors and soldiers simply didn't want to fight any longer. The spark for revolution came when the German naval command, knowing that they were basically totally fucked, decided to send their navy in a suicidal blaze of glory against the far larger British Navy. This was basically just like we didn't really fight in this war at all, so let's just kill thousands of people to save our pride. German sailors had been an incredibly rebellious group throughout the war. They'd been inspired by the Russian Revolution. And in August 1917, where this photo is from, 5,000 sailors organized themselves into clandestine Soviets, which is just the Russian word for council, in German, Rat, for a revolutionary struggle against war. So that's very important, but I'm just going to put a pin on that now because we'll see these bodies reemerge later. The Sailor Soviet was repressed, its leaders were executed, and that horrific repression inspired Lenin to, in the lead up to the October Revolution, to actually assess that the potential for international revolution was very real. And that revolt, which inspired the Russian Revolution, ironically, was again to play an important role in Germany. So when the order to sally forth to face the British Navy came, the sailors mutinied. And when the authorities cracked down and arrested hundreds of sailors, a sailors' council was elected at the port town of Kiel on November 3rd, led by USPD members, and it raised the slogan of bread and peace. When the soldiers were sent to quell the uprising, they instead joined it, and by November the 4th, 1918, Kiel was under the control of 40,000 sailors, soldiers, and workers, represented by a Soviet on the Russian model. So over the next few days, The sailors and workers would travel across Germany to spread the revolution, leading to the establishment of workers' and soldiers' councils all across Germany. And you get I love that photo of the sailors because they look very happy marching away from Kiel. Mirroring events inside Germany, soldiers on the front lines of the war organized their own councils, which usurped the authority of the chain of command across the entirety of the German military and refused to fight any longer. And by November 9th, Berlin was in the throes of revolution, the capital of Germany, with SPD leader Philipp Scheidemann proclaiming the overthrow of the Kaiser, the Emperor, and the establishment of a republic at the same time as Karl Liebknecht, who'd just been released from prison, proclaimed a socialist republic. So the immediate aftermath of the revolution produced a classic dual power scenario. Dual power is a concept where two sources of authority for state power exist in contest with each other. Both of these sources of power in Germany were established by a Berlin Congress of Workers' and Soldiers' Councils, which met literally the day after the revolution on November 10th. And this Congress elected both an executive committee of the councils, which was sort of like, yeah, represented and reflected the interests of the councils, as well as a six-person Council of People's Commissars, which is the name of the revolutionary workers' government in Russia, with three representatives from the SPD and three from the USPD. So these two bodies basically represented the two sides of the dual power. On one side, you had thousands of councils of workers and soldiers, the real authorities all over Germany, culminating the executive committee in Berlin, the capital city and the most economically important, politically important city. The workers' and soldiers' councils operated very unevenly across Germany. In many places, the initial enthusiasm to implement socialism and imitate Russia had run up against the weakness of organized revolutionary forces. So councils voluntarily ceded their power back to local governments, or the councils themselves were just run by liberals, smaller liberals, or SPD members that didn't actually challenge the status quo. But in the major industrial cities, the councils became a real power. And the way they functioned there were the delegates were elected from among workers, they were paid no more than those they represented, and they were subject to immediate recall from mass assemblies of workers in their workplaces. Councils like these were elected in Hamburg, Bremen, Stuttgart, Leipzig, Chemnitz, and Brunswick, and they were all led by revolutionaries from the very start. And that's basically the biggest cities in Germany. These councils began to attempt to govern in the interests of workers, doing things like seizing empty properties to house people by arresting some of the leading figures of the old regime and replacing the police with the workers' militia. But everywhere the councils were hamstrung by the reality that the old state power was quickly reforming behind the facade of the really terribly misnamed Council of People's Commissars, but also more importantly, the SPD. So while the most class-conscious and militant workers, particularly the revolutionary shop stewards in Berlin, opposed the SPD for their sacrificing of workers' interests to the war, most workers continued to support the SPD. This was particularly the case amongst the soldiers who were newly awakened to political activity, which was millions of people. The SPD positioned themselves as for a peaceful and democratic transition to socialism now that the war was over. This was nothing more than pure cynicism, however. The SPD leaders by this time were totally invested in the existing state, with no broader political horizons than their capacity to scramble to the top of the bloody pile. As the revolution was unfolding, so in the days between November 3rd and November 9, SPD leader Friedrich Ebert, in discussions with members of the imperial government, said, "If the Kaiser doesn't abdicate, a social revolution is unavoidable, but I do not want it. Indeed, I hate it like sin." And the SPD's goals, as reflected in that, were to just get out in front of the revolutionary ferment in order to control the tide. Just like, Philipp Scheidemann proclaiming the Republic to stop Liebknecht from proclaiming the Socialist Republic and to crush and isolate the influence of the revolutionary left. So all the old elements of the state quickly learned that the SPD could be trusted to defend their interests. So as I mentioned, in the dying days of the empire, Ebert had met with the imperial government. He'd actually been appointed prime minister by the old regime, and a large attempt to rescue themselves, so make themselves look more progressive. So Ebert was thus the head of the new government installed by the revolution, and he was the recognized leader of the old imperial state. So very quickly, Ebert assured Field Marshal Hindenburg, who later as president of the Republic would appoint Hitler Chancellor, that the government would preserve the military hierarchy. The SPD starved the revolutionary councils of funding, and they protected capitalist control over the press, which is very important. Like, if the revolutionaries and workers can't get their opinions out there, very much weakens their case. Yet another element weakening the councils and propping up the capitalists was the class collaborationists, SPD union officials. These people met with the big capitalists early on in the revolution and then negotiated an 8-hour day. Fantastic. But they did so by saying, we'll demand an 8-hour day in exchange for holding back the struggle, preventing workers from fighting for control of production and socialization. So over the ensuing months in Germany, society was gripped by a debate between these two very unevenly matched poles, with workers' and soldiers' councils blindly groping towards socialism, and the SPD-led government, with basically the entirety of the ruling class, attempting to preserve the system. The debate was not presented as between capitalism and exploitation versus socialism and freedom, but democracy versus class dictatorship, which sounds ironic, right? Because class dictatorship is capitalism, isn't it? Democracy is socialism. But no, democracy meant all the old reactionaries who had never lifted a finger for the rights of the workers and the oppressed rebranded themselves as Democrats. And as the SPD put it, not all power to the Soviets, but all power to the whole people. So this is just pure spin. By claiming that bourgeois parliamentarianism was democratic for enfranchising everyone and not just the workers, the SPD covered up the reality that they were not for the workers exercising democratic control of the economy. Therefore, they're for continuing the tyranny of the rule of the big capitalists and landowners. So Rosa Luxemburg, as I got the quote up there, she gave the best response to this argument in the Spartacist newspaper, Die Rote Fahne, which is the red flag, saying, today it is not a question of democracy or dictatorship. The question that history has placed on the agenda is bourgeois democracy or socialist democracy. So these arguments raged among the workers' and soldiers' councils for over a month in preparation for the first National Congress of the councils, which met in Berlin on December 16th. We had that's a photo of it there, actually, on the right. But this Congress proved to be a significant defeat for revolutionary advocates of workers' power. A majority of the 500 delegates were SPD members, as against just 90 USPD members. And over those 90, only 10 were Spartacists. So our motion to maintain workers' councils as a supreme authority in legislative and executive matters was defeated by 344-98 votes. The vote to call an election for a national assembly, so basically a democratic parliament, which would draft a new constitution for January 19th, 1919, which was only a month away, passed 400-50. A revolutionary remarked that the Congress was a suicide club for voting for their own destruction, while the SPD crowed that the workers had refused to become dictators. It would take bitter lessons for the workers to understand the real nature of the capitalist democracy that the SPD stood for. It was only after this Congress and 6 weeks after the revolution began that members of the Spartacist League and another small group, the International Communists, decided to break once and for all with the reformists and form an explicitly revolutionary Communist Party of Germany, or in its German acronym, KPD. Its tiny membership of only 3,000 paled in comparison to the weight of the SPD and the USPD. And being formed in the heat of revolution, the party was far from politically clear, cohered, and experienced, a problem even able leaders like Zetkin, Luxemburg, and Leibniz could not overcome. So some of the things that they discussed and decided on the founding Congress on December 30th indicate the difficulties the party would face. A majority of members voted to refuse to participate in the elections to the National Assembly, despite the fact that literally days before, a clear majority of class-conscious workers had just voted for it to take place. And the KPD opposed this on the basis that by their participating in democratic elections, it would legitimize the institution. Most members of the KPD similarly opposed working within the trade unions on the basis that these trade union leaders had just sold out the workers to support the war. But both of these decisions, I think, indicate the immaturity of the KPD. They were intoxicated by the surface appearance of revolutionary events, but ignored the signs that most workers were far from seeing parliaments or trade unions as obsolete. Furthermore, these decisions were made in the face of opposition from the leadership of the party. So Luxemburg, Leibniz, others I've mentioned, actually opposed these decisions and yet they were still made against them. So I think that really shows the Spartacist leaders' failure to build a clear organization instead of just like a loose political tendency. The KPD was too small and too immature as a party to really be a factor in the revolution for many months, if not years. So while the revolutionary left was basically scrambling around and getting only beginning to get organized, the pro-capitalist forces were undertaking their most important task of reconstituting a loyal armed force which could be used to put down workers. The biggest barrier to this aspiration was the soldiers. Try as they might, the authorities struggled to convince the returning soldiers that they should remain under military discipline under the officers who just led them into this carnage for years. Soldiers were organized in their own Soviets, and they just demanded, actually, we want total democratization of the army. We don't want power to be in the hands of these officers. But towards the end of 1918, the reactionary forces, was able to find the tool for the job in the formation of the Freikorps. So the Freikorps was a volunteer organization of soldiers who were motivated to crush communism. Like, there are people who signed up because they thought, oh, our country's under threat from within. And they were paid more than the ordinary soldiers by the military hierarchy to be maintained in this way. In important respects, the Freikorps were predecessors of fascism in the sense that they were open advocates of a violent suppression of all democratic aspirations of the working class. And by January 1919, some 80,000 soldiers were organized into the Freikorps. So it's a pretty formidable weapon on the side of the SPD-led government. And you can see the Minister of War, the pick of the hat, meeting the Freikorps there. So while this is sort of happening, popular sentiment in the capital, Berlin, which is a city of 4 million people, was increasingly polarized between most workers who backed the USPD in Berlin and wanted to see the revolution smash the military hierarchy and make real moves towards workers' control over the factories. And then on the other hand, still mass supported SPD, who wanted the revolution to take place through democratic channels, right and proper channels. Most of the SPD supporters would have supported some form of socialism, but thought it should happen without a confrontation with capitalism. Berlin was the center of strikes against the war, and it was the base of the revolutionary shop stewards. So this sort of polarization between these two parties turned into an open crisis with the dismissal of Emil Eichhorn from his role as police chief on the 4th of January, 1919. Eichhorn was a member of the USPD. He was an old revolutionary. He was actually a journalist, but he became police chief during the insurrection of November. And he'd used his position to do inconvenient things like investigate the links between the SPD and the Freikorps and also the military hierarchy. So his sacking was a clear-cut attempt to undermine the revolutionary forces. And it was responded with a massive outpouring of sentiment from the workers of Berlin. The revolutionary shop stewards met and resolved unanimously for a general strike in protest. And the KPD, keep in mind, was only like 3 days old, agreed. And together with the USPD, these groups issued a leaflet the next day calling for a demonstration at 2 p.m. And the KPD explained that the demonstration was to show that the revolutionary spirit of the November days is not extinguished. While the various revolutionary groups had planned this to be merely a show of force, they were blown away by the response of the workers. So Paul Levi, a leading member of the KPD, described the crowd. And the photo on the left is the crowd he's describing. The photo on the right is the crowd the next day. So what we saw in Berlin was perhaps the largest proletarian mass action in history. They'd brought their weapons, they carried their red banners. They were ready to do anything, to give anything, even their lives. It was an army of 200,000, such as no general had ever seen. And Eichhorn matched the enthusiasm and spirit of the rally when he said that, "I got my job from the revolution and I shall give it up only to the revolution." The show of strength from the workers threw the rally organizers into a crisis. So while this rally was happening, there was a frenzied meeting involving Liebknecht, another KPD member called Wilhelm Peik of the KPD. The USPD members were also meeting, and shop stewards. And they were discussing how they could maintain the momentum of the struggle. It seemed to them that no longer was it just a question of opposing the dismissal of Eichhorn, obviously like a relatively minor issue, but that the Berlin workers might be prepared to overthrow the Ebert SPD government. So as these leaders met, there was like spontaneous workers' occupations of the SPD newspaper and a number of other bourgeois newspapers. And there was also news arrived that the revolutionary sailors, so some of these sailors who had revolted in Kiel, actually constituted themselves in a revolutionary force called the People's Marine Division. And also the Berlin garrison of soldiers would support an uprising against the government. Two leading members of the revolutionary shop stewards, Richard Müller, who I had on the screen before, also a fellow called Ernst Dormig, rightly urged caution and resolutely refused to go along with this plan, arguing that the evidence simply wasn't there, that the majority of workers across the country were prepared for such a step. But the vast majority, largely from the USPD, but including Liebknecht and Pike from the KPD, voted to undertake an insurrection, and they constituted themselves as a 52-person revolutionary committee. So it's quite a big revolutionary committee. So this decision was on the 5th of January, and it was made along with the revolutionary proclamation. But already by the next day, it became clear that they had terribly miscalculated. So that photo on the right is actually the photo of the general strike they called on the 6th of January. 500,000 workers filled the city, absolutely massive. But at the same time, the Marine Division said that they wanted nothing to do with this. They hadn't been consulted. And while the Berlin workers were willing to strike in this massive show of force, the number willing to wage a struggle to overthrow an ostensibly socialist government was tiny. So factories across Berlin, while they were sending out delegations and coming back from this general strike, in mass assemblies passed resolutions opposing fratricidal strife between socialists. So in this situation, a day after they called for an revolution, the revolutionary committee, dominated by USPD members, votes 41 to 10 to call off the insurrection and instead to negotiate with the government. So the SPD leaders and the government, meanwhile, were determined not to let the left off the hook. They denounced what they called the dictatorship of Liebknecht and Rosa Luxemburg, even though Luxemburg or the broader KPD leadership hadn't even been involved. So while carrying on negotiations for a few days, the government was actually mobilizing the Freikorps. So in this incredibly fraught situation, the KPD barely functioned. Their leadership was only able to properly meet without Liebknecht some days later. There were two clear positions that were argued amongst the KPD leaders. One view was that the KPD should publicly call for a retreat, recognizing that the situation was very dangerous, that most workers were not prepared for civil war. The other, argued by Luxemburg, and which carried the day, was that while they agreed that the situation was not ripe for revolution, that the KPD should instead criticize the revolutionary delegates and the USPD from the left as sabotaging the struggle by their indecisiveness. Luxemburg argued that the workers had been obliged to take up arms because they faced a violent provocation from the government. And it was a question of honor for the revolution to repel that attack immediately. Well, in my opinion, comrades could definitely talk about, while something can be said for Luxemburg's determination to stand with the workers in struggle, her argument that they basically were obliged to just follow along with the workers, I think leaves out the essential role and responsibility of revolutionary leadership. At that very moment, the KPD was being denounced all across the country as for violent anarchy and for the dictatorship and against democracy. As I said, they were saying that this move was an initiative of the KPD. By refusing to clearly say what they actually believed was that this, which was a very bad miscalculation, and instead attempting to appear more radical than the USPD leaders who had called for such an insane action, the KPD leadership gave the SPD leaders a stick to beat them with, and the result was an utter tragedy. So the next few days, which is historically subsequently being called the Spartacist Uprising, was basically a period of horrific massacres by the Freikorps carried out against Berlin workers. All the workers' occupations across the city were violently broken up, with about 200 people killed. And all the while, the Freikorps was actively seeking the leaders of the left, particularly the reviled Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Liebknecht. And they were eventually found on January 15th, tortured and then executed. Luxemburg's body was thrown into a canal and only identified nearly 5 months later. So the horror of the crushing of the Berlin workers and the assassination of the most renowned leaders of the revolutionary left was just a prelude of what was to come. The social democratic-led reaction was emboldened by the results of the elections to the National Assembly, which was held 4 days after the murder of Liebknecht and Luxembourg, and saw the SPD receive the largest vote at 38%, and then go on to form another governing coalition with the bourgeois parties. The National Assembly, feeling confident that they represented the majority, tore up the demands of the soldiers' councils for democratization of the military and of the workers to socialize industry. Under the SPD Minister of War, Gustav Nosk, the Freikorps went on a rampage around the country, crushing workers' council governments in Bremen, Munich, and elsewhere. And Nosk, who was apparently a socialist, relished his role, declaring that one of us has to do the job of executioner. So huge strikes took place in protests across the country. And by March, the Berlin Workers' Council led a general strike centered on the Ruhr, Saxony, and Berlin, which people might not know, but are just major industrial areas in Germany. Despite the best efforts of the KPD and USPD leaders to maintain the strike on peaceful terrain, the Freikorps, which occupied Berlin, was able to provoke the People's Marine Division into an open warfare after shooting a sailor in the back who'd been negotiating with them. And this led to an open civil war that entirely eclipsed the so-called Spartacus uprising. Nosk authorized the shooting on the spot of any person found with weapons. After crushing the struggle, the Freikorps killed around 3,000 people, including the horrific execution of one out of every 10 members of the People's Marine Division. So this period of open terrorism lasted until May the 3rd with the crushing of the Bavarian Soviet Republic. And yet more revolutionary leaders were killed in this period, including Leo Jogiches and Eugene Levine. So this period was not the end of the revolutionary struggle in Germany. Elements of the German military, with the support of the Freikorps, would in January 1920 attempt to actually totally overthrow the so-called democracy that they've been defending and institute a military dictatorship, and they would be totally smashed by a general strike. The KPD was able to grow into a mass party, and eventually it split the USPD. It was only by the end of 1923 that the revolutionary period in Germany had come to a close, but the events of the revolution of November 1918, the destruction of the workers' councils, and the decisive defeat of the revolutionary leaders cast its pall over all subsequent events. The KPD was never able to recover its verve, and it was unable to consummate the revolutionary possibilities of the period, not just for Germany, but for the entire world. So I think to sum up some of these things, I think there are a number of important things we can conclude from this period. Firstly, it proves that workers' revolution is not just a product of poor and undeveloped countries like Russia. Germany had a democratically elected parliament, albeit with limited powers prior to the revolution. It was the second largest economy in the world behind only the United States. Berlin was a massive metropolis, and German workers were the majority of the country's 65 million people. German workers and soldiers formed councils, Soviets, just like the Russians, in an attempt to give workers real power in society. So while the German Revolution presented a similar picture to Russia in many important respects, it differed in just as significant ways, which point towards battles we have to fight in developed capitalist countries today. The German bourgeoisie and the reformists were much more ruthless and determined than in Russia. And tragically, the revolutionary proletarian current, embodied in the form of the Spartacus League and the KPD, was extremely disorganized. The German tragedy is the ultimate example of the importance for revolutionaries to be organized well before a revolution takes place, not only to build up their numerical weight, but in order to develop experience in presenting one's politics and intervening as revolutionaries in all manner of struggles, well before we have to fight the literal life and death struggle of the revolution. Had such a revolutionary party been built prior to the revolution in Germany, the potential for the things I've been describing today to go further into a coordinated revolutionary challenge would have been much, much greater. So I think it's only fair to end today's talk by giving the last word to Rosa Luxemburg. Immediately prior to her murder, she actually summarized the lessons of the rising of the Berlin workers in words that sound as if they were written today. Okay, let's see if I can get through it. She says, "Order prevails in Warsaw. Order prevails in Paris. Order prevails in Berlin. Every half century, that is what the bulletins from the Guardians of Order proclaim from one center of the world historic struggle to the next. And the jubilant victors fail to notice that any order that needs to be regularly maintained through bloody slaughter heads inexorably towards its own destiny, its own demise. The whole road of socialism, so far as revolutionary struggles are concerned, is paved with nothing but thunderous defeats, Yet at the same time, history marches inexorably step by step towards final victory. Where would we be today without those defeats from which we draw historical experience, understanding, power, and idealism? Today, as we advance in the final battle of the proletarian class war, we stand on the foundation of those very defeats, and we cannot do without any of them, because each one contributes to our strength and understanding. Order prevails in Berlin. You foolish lackeys, your order is built on sand. Tomorrow, the revolution will rise up again, clashing its weapons, and to your horror, it will proclaim with trumpets blazing, I was, I am, I shall be.